Thanks so much for joining us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. You may know how to jump a battery in a traditional vehicle, but what about a hybrid? Jim Ward in the studio with me today. He's the service manager at Smart Motors. Over 10 years of master certification, stops by every other month, actually, to help with your vehicle questions, and I hope you'll join in. We'll start with batteries, and how to jump. Well, that's a good way to put it, I guess. Start your batteries. But we'll also talk about other kinds of vehicle questions as well. What would you like to know about batteries? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Jim Ward, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. It is wonderful to be here.
Jill in Menasha is already on with a question, but before we get to her, let me just ask you about hybrid vehicles. Are they all jump-started the same way?
They are not. And jump-starting vehicles has gotten quite a bit more complicated with hybrids, but and it's not even safe to say anymore that all hybrids are standardized, because Hyundai and Kia have come out with a model they went with a different direction. They didn't go with a standard 12-volt battery like conventional cars and even hybrids have traditionally have. They have a lithium battery that kind of allows the car to sort of jump start itself if the main operating battery fails. So there's some interesting variations. There are hybrids out there that have a 12-volt battery in a fairly standardized location under the hood that can be jump-started like a conventional car, but there are hybrids that have a different type of battery, but are called AGM batteries, that don't outgas the sulfuric acid that a regular battery does, and they're actually in the cabin of the car, sometimes under the back seat. Some of those have special jump-start connectors, posts under the hood away from the battery so that it's still convenient under the hood to jumpstart them.
Yeah.
But when it comes to hybrids, you really have to take a look at the owner's manual, go by the manufacturer's instructions, because there are so many variables now. Other than the new Hyundai and Kia that have their own method of jump-starting themselves, all of them can be jump-started. You want to use a little more caution if you're trying to jump-start another car from your hybrid, because the hybrid battery, the 12-volt battery in most hybrids, is a fairly small battery. It really just runs the computers. It typically doesn't have the power, jump-starting power, that a conventional battery would have. So you can jump-start a hybrid. You may be able to jump-start another car from a hybrid, but that's a bit more of a challenge.
And remind us how a traditional car is jump-started.
Well, in a traditional car, before you're going to attempt to jump-start, you're going to make sure that the batteries are of similar voltage. I mean, almost everything out there is 12-volt, but there are some 24-volt systems out there. You want to make sure you're dealing with the same voltage. You want to have the cars as close together without touching, so that the locations of the battery are as close together as possible. Then with both cars off and in park, you're going to connect the jumper cables. There's a very specific order. You're going to take the red clamp, the positive, from the on the post of the dead battery. You're going to connect the other red clamp to the post of the good battery. And then you're going to connect the black negative to the post of the good battery, and then carefully connect the black clamp, the last one, to metallic part of the engine of the vehicle that's being jump-started. Because when you connect that one, there could be some sparks. You don't want those sparks to be right over the battery. Typically, you're going to connect this to near the hood latch or some other metal surface away from the battery. And then you're going to start the working car, let it idle for a few minutes. That is going to actually let the battery in the dead car absorb some voltage and charge up a little bit, and then you try starting the dead car, and if it does, you immediately jump start or immediately disconnect the cables in the reverse order. If it doesn't, then you want to give it at least 30 seconds to a minute to wait and attempt again.
There we go. Well, Jill in Menasha has a question relating to batteries, so let's go there. Jill, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question has to do with battery tenders. I have a Saab 9.5 that I very seldom drive because I have a Toyota that is basically gets better mileage, and I don't have to worry about shopping carts hitting it. But I've had a battery tender on it for, oh gosh, probably about a year and a half. I drive it just occasionally. Haven't really driven it for a number of months. But I went to open the door the other day, and the interior lights didn't come on. Can battery tenders hurt a car if they're on for a long time, or
Yeah.
You know, well, Jill, if they're working normally, they don't. I mean, and just so we're defining and talking about the same things, a battery tender is a smart battery charger. It's a battery charger that has the ability to sense if the battery has a full state of charge, in which case it goes into a ready mode, a standby mode, and it's not continually charging the battery. It only charges it when there is need, when the battery voltage gets below a certain point. So a battery tender is something that is plugged into a wall, into 110, and it's plugged into your battery. A lot of times you can just put it on a car temporarily, or sometimes they're actually installed under the hood and you have a cord sticking out the grill, kind of like an engine heater, and can plug it in when it's in the garage. If it's working right, it should keep the battery charged, and you should be able to keep that plugged in indefinitely. So I'm not sure what happened there. If the power goes off at some point, it's possible that thing gets tripped off and doesn't get reset and turned back on. Depending on your circuitry, a battery tender, like any electrical device, can fail and go bad, but a properly working battery tender can be left on a car indefinitely.
There you go. Thank you, Jill, for calling. Appreciate it. Kathleen in Houston, Minnesota. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a GEM. It's GEM, and it's a battery-operated vehicle. And it takes 6 batteries, and last year it worked, and this year it doesn't work. Do I need to replace all the batteries?
There should be some testing that could be done. I'm not very familiar with the GEM, I'm going to be honest. And so I'm not sure what the diagnostic procedure would be there. But ultimately, the batteries may not have failed. Batteries constantly get discharged and are able to be recharged many, many times over. So it is possible for a battery to fail, but that's what has to be determined. A battery needs to be tested to find out if it could be recharged and still have serviceable life, or if it has failed.
So you probably want to go to somebody who knows.
Well, probably want to go to a dealer that is familiar. Because I don't think this is going to be something most conventional shops are going to be very familiar with. Although, that testing may not be overly complicated. I would probably do a search to find out where a nearing servicing dealer is. But, I'm not familiar with the diagnostic procedure for that particular electric car.
There we go. Good luck, Kathleen. Thank you very much for calling. Brett in Menominee, it's your turn. Hi, Brett.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've got a question. I'm interested in a Toyota Prius. I've found quite a bit of information online. I'm a pretty handy guy. It looks like something would be pretty easy to do. It would be to pick up one used with a bad battery. I know you can buy the individual cells pretty cheaply, and it's something that I feel confident I could do myself, but then you keep doing research and you find information about not having a correctly balanced battery. I'm wondering what your guest would say to that, and also a place to find more information than just Facebook.
Yeah. Right. Well, there's nothing like a manual when you're getting into that kind of work. It's first of all that the hybrid battery, particularly in a Prius, has got really high voltage, depending on the year you're looking at, 300 to 500 volts. I mean, this is enough. If you touch something to the wrong place, it is enough to be fatal. It's enough to weld metal pieces together. So that's not to say people haven't done it, but it is true that those individual cells have to be within a certain voltage of all the rest of the cells. The Prius's synergy system, the management system, isn't going to allow it to operate. It's going to set a bunch of codes if these batteries are not close together. But the type of individual batteries they are not uncommon. They're used in other applications, radio-controlled devices in particular. They do make chargers specifically for them. I know of individuals who have done that. They didn't have the greatest, longest life. In other words, they did get the thing working and got it going. Less than a year later, it died. The battery had failures again. But it can be done. You can find instructions to do it yourself. But again, like anything dealing with electricity, there are some significant precautions and things you need to be aware of. So definitely get a manual and be aware of how you disconnect the service plug and how you keep yourself safe when you're handling it.
There you go. Thank you so much, Brett, for calling. And, with a car, I've got a Prius now. Well, it's actually going to be my daughter's once she gets her license. But it's sitting in the driveway. I drive it once a week just to drive it. Is that an okay practice?
Which is a good idea. Yep, they do need to be driven. A hybrid doesn't like to sit around. I mean, they have any modern vehicle built in the last few years has got far more computers in it that need to maintain a certain level of power to keep everything managed and working right. So you're taking it out once a week. Hopefully you're driving at least 20 miles, something mm-hmm. in that range. Yeah. 20 to 30 miles would probably be even better if it's just once a week. But, yep, you want to keep the battery charged, both the hybrid and the 12-volt battery, and that will do it.
All right. Nick in Brookfield, it's your turn now. Hi, Nick.
Oh, batteries, I'm ready to tear my hair out. I got a motorcycle, and it's not really a motorcycle question, but I bought a brand new battery about a year and a half ago.
Yep.
And when I bought the motorcycle, I bought one of those fancy $100 battery tenders and conditioner and everything.
Mm-hmm.
I had it plugged in religiously during the winter, and for some reason it's not holding a charger, so that's bad. Can those batteries go bad that quick? I tried to bring it back to the manufacturer, and they're like, nope, the warranty's over.
Mm.
Really?
That's too bad. I mean, it's not typical. Battery technology and battery life is better than it's ever been, but that doesn't mean that a fairly new battery. I mean, we do see batteries sometimes fail on cars, you know, before they're even sold. I mean, it's not, again, very, very much the exception, but it does happen.
So you may have another trip to the battery store, Nick.
Yeah. If it has a bad cell, there's nothing else you can do about it but replace it.
All right, there you go. Thank you for calling. By the way, you can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Mark in Rochester Hills, Michigan, your turn. Hi, Mark.
Good morning.
Morning.
The comment made a little bit ago about leaving a battery tender on a battery will pose no harm is not quite correct. If you have a battery that is somewhat discharged and you leave it on a battery tender, it will continue to cycle on and off as the battery discharges itself, and that will result in a long term, and I'm talking maybe 4 to 5 months, of sulfiding up the plates of the battery. So if you want to prevent that from happening, you have to look for a battery tender that periodically goes into a desulfiding phase. Now, this isn't a problem if you run the car periodically, because charging circuits in modern automobiles all blast it with a pretty heavy amperage and desulfide the battery plates anyway. But don't leave something on a trickle charger for months on end, even a smart charger, if it doesn't have that desulfiding phase.
Hmm. Well, what do you think, Jim?
Well, that is absolutely true. I mean, again, I'm talking about a actual battery tender, and most of the ones that I've seen marketed the last few years do have the desulfiding phase in them, and you know, typically talking about a car that has got a known good battery to start with. But yep, you can definitely run into problems if you have a low charged battery to start with.
All right, there we go. Thanks, Mark. Appreciate it. Joey in Westby, your turn. Hi, Joey.
Hey, I bought a USB charger that plugs into my cigarette lighter, or 12-volt outlet, as they call it now. And it shows on the LED display, it shows the amps and the volts. So, you know, I just have a little gauge on my dash that you know, doesn't really indicate anything. But this tells me exactly what my amps and volts are when I'm driving, when I'm parked, when it's on, when it's off. And I just unplug it when I'm not using it. And I think it's a great way to keep track of the alternator and the battery.
Hmm.
So this USB device is not just telling you the available amperage and voltage at your USB, but telling you what your car is performing at.
Exactly, yeah. I had bought it originally for my motorcycle, just to have USB outlets on the motorcycle. And I thought, wow, what a great idea. I know exactly what my volts are when I'm driving. I know what my alternator is putting out. And they're only they're less than $10 on Amazon. So if you look for a USB charger, you'll come up with some that have little LED indicators that show you the volts and the amps. And you can keep track exactly of what's going on with your alternator and battery while you're driving.
Yeah, it's amazing what the what the prices of those things have become.
For 10 bucks or less. Oh, man. Joey, thanks. Appreciate that call very much. Jim Ward, our guest today. He's service manager at Smart Motors of Madison. Great to have him with us today. Certainly, if you have questions for him, join in at 1-800-642-1234. We've got open lines, get you on pretty quickly. Or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. Tyler Ditter, our engineer today, Joan Ledeau, our producer, and you are listening to the Ideas Network. Talking vehicle maintenance today with Jim Ward of Smart Motors Toyota of Madison. Great to have him with us. Thank you for listening in. Questions for him, we've zeroed in on batteries, but we're taking other questions as well. 1-800-642-1234. Email at ideas@wpr.org. A listener emailed that filling his car with gas has become a problem recently. He has to trickle it in or the gas pump kicks it off. It happens at all pumps, so he's pretty sure it has to be a car issue. With this weather, taking 10 minutes to fill the car up is not the funnest thing to do. Also, he can't tell how much gas he's actually putting in because the gauge is only readable when the car is on. Any cheap or easy ways to fix this?
Well, I've seen that symptom before, and most of the gas, the filler on the car that you're putting the pump's nozzle into is vented. It can't just have the liquid come down, and that vent tube can get restricted for different reasons. It can be something like spiderweb material that gets in there, or it can be any sort of debris that might get in there that's not going to let the air vent out. Which is not going to allow you to put the gas in. So there are some tests that can be done. This is unfortunately something where you're dealing with raw fuel vapors and potentially raw fuel. So I don't know if this is exactly a do-it-yourselfer thing. When we diagnose parts of that vent and evaporative system, we use a little smoke machine like makes the smoke for the disco floor that you hook up and pump into that system and watch for where it does and doesn't flow or if there are any leaks. But, it would be the type of diagnosis we do for those systems that would have to be done to find out, why it's not flowing through that vent pipe. And then it probably had to be taken off and cleaned out to correct that.
So at least you know why. I probably wouldn't try to fix it myself.
Yeah, that's not a good do-it-yourself.
Oh, Jeff in Superior, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Jeff.
Yes, thank you, gentlemen. I really want to have a conversation. I have two questions. My first question is, when we drive up to the pump, we're given a choice. We can choose 91 octane, 88, 85 octane. Sometimes it's 90 octane. Every brand has its own rating, its own octane rating. A lot of times people will just simply choose the least expensive one, but they put the E85 in a separate pump. But the general knowledge when I've talked with people is, sometimes they get better fuel economy with one over another. Is there any way to gain an understanding of what's the best fuel to use?
Well, the manufacturer of your vehicle is going to have a rating for it, and most vehicles anymore are going to be able to run just fine on 87 octane. Their more high-performance vehicles will often ask for 91 or greater. I mean, there are places where you can actually buy racing fuel, 105, 106 octane, which is not what you want to use in most cars. And when it comes to alcohol, that doesn't really change. I mean, almost everything in Wisconsin now is going to have the 10 to 15% ethanol. That doesn't really change the octane rating. Typically, the difference in price between the regular 87 and premium 91 is such that even if you get a slightly better fuel mileage with the higher octane, you're probably paying enough more for the fuel that it really doesn't pay. And the car's fuel system is dialed in for a specific octane to work at its optimum with that octane fuel in it. So there really isn't a reason to use premium if that's not what your manufacturer calls for.
So look to the owner's manual and check it out.
Right.
And I like that fact that I can put 87 octane in my vehicle for sure.
Yep, it's easy. Although it is, people every single month will see a person or two who will fill a car with E85, which is really only for flex fuel vehicles. If you fill a whole tank, you may have problems driving it. Sometimes you can burn that off, and even diesel. So you do need to pay attention. You can put the wrong nozzle in and fill a car up with the wrong type of fuel.
There we go. John in Racine, your turn. Hi, John.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I have a It's a 2009 Toyota Corolla, and it's when the engine's cold and the gas tank is below half a tank, it's a hard starting. So
it cranks over good, battery's good, it just cranks and cranks and doesn't want to fire and start. Is that right?
Yeah, it takes a long time, but if the gas tank is over half, it usually starts on the first try.
Yeah.
Well, fuel supply, and I think I'm trying to remember in 09 if the tank is in the pump, or excuse me, the pump is in the tank on that vehicle, and I believe it is, so it is very possible that the pickup tube is compromised in that gas tank, and it's really only getting fuel properly when the tank is full. When the tank is half full, if that pickup has got anything wrong with it, it may not pick up as much fuel. And obviously, we know a cold engine has got to have the right mixture and the right amount of fuel. It needs more fuel in the air-fuel mixture than a warm engine to start. So, that's something that they'd have to. There's an access plate on the top of the tank where they could take that off and take a look down in there and see if it is leaking back down in. But that's what this sounds like.
Sure does. You know, what's the rule on this? I've always heard in the wintertime you should always keep your tank full if you can, or pretty full.
That is a good idea, not so much for this reason. And some of the reasons that we used to recommend it aren't as much of a factor anymore. The more room there is over the fuel in the tank, the more room there is for condensation. You get that condensation buildup, which is going to lead to some liquid water in the gas. But we use ethanol now. That alcohol tends to absorb that water. That doesn't tend to be as much of a problem anymore. The main reason really is safety. You know, if you are in a situation where you're driving in bad conditions and end up sliding off the road and have to sit and stay warm in that car for a period of time and wait for a rescue, you're better off and safer to have a full tank of fuel.
Brett called back. He didn't. He was wondering if he could replace individual cells, or do you have to?
No, you can. People have done it. Again, I haven't seen good long term results from that. But yep, you can buy those individual cells and you can swap them out and charge it, monitor the voltage and charge it up to so it's within a certain threshold to the rest of the cells, and that can be done.
All right. Yes. On to Steve in Madison. Hi, Steve.
My question involves the key to my vehicle has, you know, remote capability for unlocking the doors and opening the windows and things like that. And mine, the only one that works of mine, has a short in it that burns through the battery about every 7 to 10 days. And then I found out that I was replacing the batteries because when I called the dealer, they wanted an arm and a leg to replace the key. And I just refused to pay that. But I found out now that the short actually causes my doors and windows to open in the middle of the night when my keys are just sitting on my dresser. So I need to replace it, and I've seen some options for buying online, generic remotes, and the dealer told me that they're the only ones that can program those things for my car. But online, they seem to indicate that there is a process for doing that yourself, and I'm just wondering if you can advise me about that before
sure.
I invest in.
Yep. Now, and so some vehicles have those remote keyless functions just for locking and unlocking on the same key that you start the vehicle with, and other manufacturers have a separate remote from the key you start it with. There is a function in that key part, the part that starts the car, that is a theft deterrent immobilizer. That programming generally is going to need to be done by a dealer or a locksmith. However, the keyless function itself, the keyless unlocking, most manufacturers have processes where you could do it yourself and would not have to use, you know, a laptop or access the car's computers to program it in there. You know, I know some of the Toyotas, I can't remember the procedure off the top of my head, and it seems a little bit like the hokey pokey when you're doing it, but they, you know, if you Google it for year and model, I mean, and it'll surprise you. It'll be something like step on the gas pedal 5 times, open the driver's door, close it, lock it, unlock it. You know, they'll have you go through a series of things, do this so many times, and each step has to be within so many seconds of the last step. So sometimes you got to get your timing down. But it's absolutely true, absolutely true. Most manufacturers have a method similar to that you can program it yourself.
I'm just as an aside, I've, you know, had people, I haven't looked into it myself, but I've had people say, oh my goodness, it was like $450 or $500 to get a new key. Why the heck is it so expensive?
Well, the keys have gotten more expensive because of the technology involved. Some keys are laser cut now. Keys don't necessarily even have a key. Sometimes they're even installing into a key cylinder. And they have many other functions on them. So you have the immobilizer chip that keeps people from being able to start your car if they try hot wiring it. They have the various keyless door lock functions on them. A lot of cars now have remote start, so they have a separate button for remote start. And the programming is, and again, depending on the manufacturer, it's different for different manufacturers, but some of them, that programming charge for both parts, for both the immobilizer and the keyless part, can be an hour of labor with labor rates well into the range of, you know, $125 to $150. That, along with a key set where the key with that remote control and all those devices all within that one unit can be $200 to $300. Yeah, it adds up. You know, it's when you buy a car, they offer actual insurance now. You've always offered service contracts for mechanical breakdowns and things, but they actually offer contracts for key coverage because some of those things are so darn expensive.
Jay in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Jay.
Hey there, guys. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question regarding a 2012 Toyota Tundra that I own, and when I get out of the vehicle sometimes, especially on hot days, I get a strong LP gas smell outside the vehicle. In looking online in some forums, it says sometimes that's axle grease or axle fluid or something splashing against the exhaust pipe. I took it to a shop and they said it looks like possibly the valve cover gasket is leaking and it's dripping down into the exhaust pipe at the back of the motor. Have you ever heard of this, and do you have any ideas what might be the problem?
Well, any oil leak that gets on the exhaust is going to produce an odor, and odors, descriptions of odors are kind of a subjective thing. Burning oil doesn't strike me personally like LP gas, but, you know, if something smells off like that, and you've had it checked and they're telling you there's oil there, that's the place to start, is get that oil leak. A valve cover gasket typically is not something you can't really repair. That gasket, you replace it to stop that leak. And there's, you know, sometimes depending on where on the exhaust pipe it gets on it, they can put some degreaser on there and try to clean that off. But in most cases, that's probably going to have to burn off for a while. So even after you fix the leak, you may be noticing that odor for a week or two till the rest of the residual burns off and there's no more leaking on it.
There you go, Jay. Thank you so much for calling. Brad in Minnesota emailed that his mom has a 2017 RAV4 with 25,000 miles. She drives it nearly every day. She came out to the garage a week ago, and it was dead when she hit the start button. A message on the dash said to see the dealer. All the lights and electronics worked. She tried it later in the day, and it started. She took it to two Toyota dealerships on the same day. Both read it on the computer and came back normal. Both techs told her it might have just been a glitch. Runs great since. Any ideas? What could be beyond a glitch?
Well, and a glitch is a pretty vague description. I mean, any kind of electronic malfunction, and things can stick and give you a one time. The battery voltage might have been low, depending on, if it drives it nearly every day. If a vehicle sits a few days in cold enough weather, a battery discharge condition can occur. And later in the day, the batteries do have an ability to recover by themselves. Seemingly, if it's very cold in the morning, you try to start it and there isn't enough voltage in the battery, it doesn't start. If you have the ability to wait till later in the day when it warms up, that battery may have recovered enough to start. And by the time you drive it to the dealer, everything tests good and it's not really showing a fault. One of the other things that we see, and this used to be far more obvious when every car had a key that you stuck into a cylinder, an ignition cylinder to start it. Every now and then you'd go to do that and the key wouldn't turn all the way. And you'd realize, oh, my steering wheel lock is involved here. And I think for most people, it kind of became a second nature thing in the 90s. Oh, the key doesn't turn far enough. Take my left hand, move the steering wheel a little bit. Now I can turn the key and it starts. Modern vehicles that don't have an ignition cylinder that you put a key in, just have the start button, the start switch, also have that ability to have the steering wheel locked and prevent it from starting. And you wouldn't have that same feedback from the key not turning, so you may not realize what's going on. So if depending on the manufacturer, usually there's a light that is not going to be the correct color. If the light's not green on a Toyota, that steering lock is probably engaged. And this is not something that happens often. It may only happen to you once a year, or you may never have it happen to you. It might happen to you once in 5 years. But something like that can go on, too, where it's not, there's not really a glitch going on. It just, you know. So if you have a car that's got a start button and you in this situation it doesn't want to start, if you try turning the steering wheel and it's locked, that is the problem. The wheel should not be locked at that point. You should shut it off, move the wheel a little bit, try it again. There's no way to know in this particular case what it was, but that's one of the things that was pretty mysterious to us in this new start button vehicles until we came across
figured
it ourselves.
It out. Right. Yeah, there you go. Interesting. Bob in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Bob.
Hi. I have a 2011 Camry, and I recently replaced the battery on it. And following that, I noticed that my driver's side back door window control was not working. The automatic window wasn't working. And then I've noticed that when I'm driving at night, the lights are on the driver's side door, there's the four buttons to control the four windows. The driver side button stays illuminated, but the other three buttons flash. Does that flashing indicate something?
Well, it is, and I don't know off the top of my head. And that's continuous. At night when the lights are on, those others are flashing. And this is not something that really should be directly related to a battery replacement. One thing we do know about power windows and several other systems on a vehicle is that they have some programming that is we refer to as initialization. It's not typically like with your rear window that it works or doesn't work. But for example, the automatic function, typically the driver's window in that car at least, will have an auto function where when you operate its switch, the window, if you touch it in a certain spot and touch it right, the window should close all the way itself rather than having to hold your finger on the button. That is part of initialization. So typically, if you replace a battery, you may lose that initialization during the brief period the batteries are disconnected. And for that power window, that particular procedure to reinitialize it is as simple as running the window all the way up, hold your finger a couple seconds on that button in the up position, run it all the way down, hold your finger a couple seconds on that down position after it's down. And that usually resets that initialization. I'm not sure that the lights flashing are an indication it's not initialized, but that may be. So I would at least – the first thing I would try is going through that initialization. That really is not likely to have anything to do with the rear window not working, and that really shouldn't be related to a battery replacement. Although one thing I've often seen, people will often describe some electrical things that don't work after a battery replacement. And often what we find is that it wasn't really the replacement of the battery directly. It's the fact that a battery died. There was an attempt to jumpstart the car. The jumpstarting caused an arc somewhere that caused a fuse to blow.
Oh.
That fuse is going to keep that device from working. So in a way, it's related to replacing a battery. In a way, it's not. That's the kind of thing I guess I would be looking for in this instance, because the battery replacement itself shouldn't cause anything but that initialization issue.
There you go, Bob. Thank you for calling. Sharon in Barneveld, your turn now. Hi, Sharon.
Hi, this is Sharon.
Yeah.
I love your show, Liz, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have an 06 RAV4, and for the last several winters, my windows fog up when I have the heater on, and I have to put the defroster on, and that pretty much takes care of it, but not if I have a lot of people in the car. And I've had a mechanic look at it, and he can't figure it out. And I was just wondering if you had any thoughts.
Well, the heating and air conditioning system itself has got to be able to direct the air to where it needs to go and to control the amount of fresh air and recirculated air that's in the vehicle to keep the windows clear. So one possibility is that something in that heater box in the dash isn't switching properly, and it's not allowing air to flow where it's supposed to go. One of the other things that that's a little bit difficult to diagnose and get to the bottom of, but that's one possibility, and probably the worst case. That's what we hope it is not. One of the other things that can happen is that there are different ways that water can get into your vehicle. So if we have a sunroof on the vehicle, sunroofs don't seal all the water out. There are drains around the outside of the sunroof, around the edge of it. And if those drains plug up, water, or if the drain tubes that run down the pillars by the windshield get plugged up, that water can end up somewhere in the interior, which is going to cause more window fogging than you should normally have. The heater and air conditioning system also has a water drain because it condenses water out of the air. It's supposed to collect in a little pan and drain out. If that drain hose is restricted, even partially, more water will be in there than it should. It's going to make it more difficult for it to defrost. So the easiest thing to check are those drains. You know, almost any technician can pour some water in and watch the operation of the air conditioner and determine whether sunroof drains, if it has a sunroof, and whether the heater, air conditioner, evaporator drains are working properly. Do that easy step first. If that's not the case, then someone's going to have to go into some rather complicated diagnostic work on that heater box to see if the various doors and vents are opening like they're supposed to.
Yeah, well, let's hope for the easy fix there.
Yep, hope for a partially plugged drain.
Thank you, Sharon. Steve in Black Earth, your turn. Hi, Steve.
Hi, yeah, thanks for taking my call. I got a question on my 2014 Toyota Tacoma.
Okay.
I got a notice in the mail about a month or two ago saying that there's some kind of recall problem with the undercarriage rusting or rotting out. And it said something about that I don't need to do nothing and I need to wait for another notice, but it's been a while. And I just kind of like for you to tell me a little more details on what the deal is on that, if you know.
Sure, I do. Toyota Tacomas and Tundras, for that matter, had some frame rust issues starting in about the year 2000, 2001. Toyota had a program for those vehicles and vehicles through about 2010, through a number of different phases. Some of those vehicles got a corrosion-resistant compound put on their frames to slow corrosion down. Other vehicles that had frames that were compromised had the frames replaced. So about 6 months ago, Toyota launched another program for 11 through 17 trucks. I think this is more just a proactive one to make sure that before those frames get to a point where there is significant rust on them, that they're getting a coating to help prevent that. So with all recalls anymore, manufacturers have to notify the dealers and the consumers at the same time they notify the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. So that's why more and more you're going to get what's called an interim notice. They're going to say, okay, we're going to be doing something, but we don't have all the parts for it yet. We don't have the procedures yet, but they have to tell you right at the time they're going to launch it. So then that's an interim notice. And then usually sometime later, 6 months to a year later, you'll get a remedy notice telling you that it's out. So Toyota's had engineers going around to dealers and training on the process for what's going to be done on those frames and getting the equipment together. We've gone through that at our dealership. I believe the notices I read are going to start going, the remedy notices I think are going to start going out to consumers early February of this next year. So it's not too far away. It'll be coming up and you'll get a notice and basically up it so that a more proactive approach can be taken to make sure that that frame has got long-term durability.
There you go, Steve. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Jim Ward, our guest today, service manager at Smart Motors Toyota of Madison. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Taking a look at vehicle maintenance, your vehicle maintenance today with our guest, Jim Ward, service manager at Smart Motors Toyota of Madison. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining in. Lots of callers online, and I think we'll just go right back to the phones, because our lines are all filled. Mike in Milwaukee will give you a chance first. Mike, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I usually every winter I take my cars to the parts stores, and one of the cars they told me the battery is bad. So I didn't believe him because the car starts every morning, even when it's cold. So I went to another store, and they said the battery checks is very bad. So What's the reason behind it? It starts every day, every time. So sure. I don't know why is the test is as bad.
Yep. Well, one of the preparation questions that I had for myself for this show was, when should a battery be replaced? And there's lots of ways to answer that, but the hope we all have is that the battery gets replaced before it fails and we're dressed up for a wedding and going to be late. Yeah. That's my luck, at least, is it's going to fail at the worst possible time for me. So modern battery testers have the ability to measure potential in a battery. I have seen, typically when that modern battery tester says that this battery doesn't necessarily have the potential to start under the harshest conditions, that is when it's going to give a fail test reading. And that doesn't mean that the battery's not necessarily testing the car right now. Batteries are rated for much more power than is typically needed to start the car. They're rated in something called cold cranking amps. And what cold cranking amps really are is just how long a battery can maintain a certain amperage voltage for 30 seconds without dropping below 7.2 volts. Because when it's extremely cold out, the battery has less available and the engine is going to be stiffer and the oil is going to be stiff. So that the test is not saying that your battery won't start your car right now. It says that, typically we expect we're going to see our customers in our shops about twice a year, about every 6 months. And what it's saying is that there's a good chance that between now and when I see you next, that car's not going to start and that battery's going to fail. So that's it. Is those testers really are picking up potential. I have seen someone where that test indicated, and this is the exception, but a test indicated a battery was failed, and the customer just decided, actually the customer was my previous boss, he was just saying, well, I'm going to monitor this and see how long I can actually go. And I think it was almost 3 years before that battery actually failed, but that's the exception. The rule usually is that once one of those modern testers says that battery is likely to fail, it's going to probably do so within 6 months.
And Mike, I would look at my calendar and see when I've got a big event coming up, a wedding or something else, and you can probably rest assured that would be the day
that
the battery failed. Oh, man. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Jeff in Eau Claire, your turn. Hi, Jeff.
Morning. Got a new battery, so that's not the issue today, but I do have a problem with the rear wiper motor on a 2012 Highlander. It's a two components, got the lift glass, the motor stopped working. But when I lift the glass and I move the wiper blade, instead of it moving relatively with ease, it seems to be gummed up. And that might have been part of the problem as to why the motor had to work so hard and possibly burned out. But is it difficult to get that second assembly of the wiper assembly out and clean that up? Or what do you recommend?
Well, I haven't seen that happen. I mean, I usually when this question comes up on any SUV, it turns out that the rear window isn't closed, and if it's not latched and closed. But it sounds like you've covered that, and you're finding that real stiff to operate, and it shouldn't be stiff to operate. So I'm not quite sure how it got in that situation, but essentially, getting at that linkage, because as you described, it's separate from the motor. When you close that window, it just sort of falls down onto a little. There's a slot that has a tab going to it, and that's how that operates. So, accessing it and using some penetrating oil to free it up is probably all it's going to take. Although I have to admit, I have not seen this on a Highlander yet, so that's kind of a new one. I could imagine any wiper linkage I've seen on several vehicles, wiper linkages get stiff, but on that rear wiper in a Highlander, this one is not one I've had go by. But that's, I don't see any reason why you have to take the panels apart, access it. You couldn't lube it up and get it working.
There you go. Thank you, Jeff. JT in Menominee emailed to ask if fuel de-icer additive is advisable anymore now that there's alcohol already added in most gasoline.
Yep, it's a good question because the fuel de-icer is isopropyl alcohol. It's basically the same thing as the ethanol that is going in the tank, and by and large, it is not necessary to use that anymore. Yep, there are some folks out there, ethanol is a little bit controversial yet, and there are some folks out there that will go out of their way to find a station where you can buy fuel without it, and for them, it is still a good idea to use a gasoline antifreeze. But if you're buying typical ethanol fuel, you don't need that anymore.
Mary in Chippewa Falls, your turn. Hi, Mary.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a 2019 hybrid RAV4, and I've been manually checking my miles per gallon at each fill-up. And I went from 44 miles a gallon down to like 32, 34.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if it you know, in the last couple months, and I'm wondering if it has anything to do with the battery, like if I got to warm up the car a certain amount of time, or...
No, warming up the car is just going to work against that. It's going to go the other way. The car is designed to warm up best by driving it. You know, in all the years, you know, I'm going on almost four decades of doing this, in all of it in Wisconsin, vehicles have always lost gas mileage in the wintertime. The longer you drive, if you have long commutes and you drive an hour or two a day, you are going to be the person who has the least loss. If you drive short trips, you know, less than 5-7 miles, you're the person who's going to have the most loss. And on average, it's typically about a third of your gas mileage. Modern hybrids improve that a little bit, but there's so many electronics and they're affected by cold. So, you know, it isn't an uncommon scenario.
No.
Depending on how you drive, it's everybody loses fuel mileage in the winter. The fuel itself is a different fuel mix for wintertime, which tends to... get a little fewer, a little less fuel mileage to begin with, but you know, combine that with the cold, the short trips. That's pretty classic. That doesn't indicate something's wrong with it.
Certainly, what's happening with my vehicles for sure. Mary, thanks so much. Tom and Nelson, your turn. Hi, Tom.
Yes, hello. Thank you. I've got a 1999 Volkswagen Passat that I've had forever, and in cold weather, usually below freezing, when it gets around 32 degrees, you start the car and all the digital readouts, the clock and the miles per gallon and so on, the miles you've traveled, all reset to zero. And the car just starts fine in the wintertime. I've never had a problem with it, but that reset happens all the time. I just wonder if there's a bad ground or something like that. I don't know.
It is likely to be a bad ground or a bad solder point somewhere that when the weather gets cold enough, it's able to open that circuit. It loses memory and basically resets itself. So you're exactly right. It you know, and unfortunately, most often these things are in the module and not easily repairable, but it could be a ground problem, and that's that basically... the difficulty is that to really accurately diagnose it, you can try cleaning and repairing grounds throughout various circuits on a vehicle, but if you don't catch it red-handed, you're not going to know for sure if you've got the right circuit. Being able to catch it, see it doing it when it's cold, catch it red-handed, and doing some measurements at a specific point are really going to be the key to knowing whether a given ground or a given circuit is what's causing it. But, yep, you're exactly right. Something, a ground or a bad solder point somewhere is opening that circuit and allowing it to reset.
There you go, Tom. Thank you. John, who's on I-94 south toward Rockford. Hi, John.
Hi. I have a question about a trailer that I have that I use for the Dane County market. The trailer is set up with a refrigerator and a freezer. I have three deep cycle batteries that are on an inverter with 3,500-watt inverter. I also have a plug-in so I can use a generator to get down to Madison. I live up near Menominee. Those batteries, usually about once a year I have to replace one, and I'm wondering, my question is, should those batteries be out of that trailer and into the house where it's warm during the winter?
Well, they do need something to maintain them. The deep cycle batteries have a different charge profile than a conventional battery. There's like three phases that they need to go through to be charged, and an inverter itself may not have the circuitry and the control mechanism for that. Most travel trailers that are built with an inverter that's designed to do this will charge those deep cycle batteries properly and maintain them if it's plugged into shore power all the time. I've got a travel trailer sitting on, you know, on my lot that is plugged in for that very reason, to keep those deep cycles charged that way. So, there is a, you know, and it's not like a regular battery charger or battery tender either. It's got to go through a few different phases of a, you know, the final one's a top-up phase. But, yeah, deep cycle batteries are different, have different requirements. And, you want to check and make sure the inverter alone may not have the circuitry you need to monitor them and charge them. And if you're not able to have it connected to shore power, then, they need to come out for the wintertime.
Thanks, John. Let's go to Carrie in West Allis. Hi.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a 05 Acura MDX, and I'm finding that the rear blade, windshield blade, mm-hmm. has to be replaced by the dealer. Is there any way around that? Because it's very costly, and it usually only lasts about a year.
Well, I am not familiar with the procedure myself, but I almost anything like this, especially something, you know, some wipers are more complicated to replace than others. Most of them are pretty easy. I got to believe if you Google this that there's somebody out there that has found a way around going to the dealer and paying them for it. You know, a lot of times you need a little, you know, for unusual, and this is, again, the exception, not the rule, but I think that rear wiper on that Acura probably is the exception. Sometimes you may need a little tool, and, you know, again, if you Google this, look on YouTube, you'll probably find, you know, people get really creative, find a way to take a coat hanger and a pair of pliers, bend it a certain way, and make the tool they need to release a clip. You know, again, I can't say that I'm familiar with that procedure, but undoubtedly someone has figured out a way to do it themselves.
There you go, Carrie. Thanks a lot for calling. And in Madison, thinking about getting a new used car, what should she look at to make sure it hasn't been affected by the 2018 Madison floods? What questions?
Well, there are some pretty good guides to take a look at when it comes to flood cars. Actually, most manufacturers, Toyota, for example, has bulletins, and most of these bulletins are accessible by the public. You can Google them about what to look for in floods, and it's pretty varied. I mean, but it's some of it's as simple as reaching up underneath the bumpers and feeling them, going in the trunk, looking underneath the spare tire down deep in that well to look and see if it looks like there's water stains, if gravel or anything has been in there. You know, there are ways to look inside a door panel and interior. So there are very specific methods, and it isn't, you know, Madison did have bad floods in 2018, but flood cars from all over the world from you know, different situations down in the Gulf and stuff end up back into the market often. And so it's some good information. If you're thinking about getting a used car, you do want to look some of that up and take some of those precautions and take a look.
There you go. Thanks so much for that question, Ann. Appreciate it very much. What about you? Join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'll take a look at the news, weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Net, and then we will be back with Jim Ward. I'm Larry Mueller. You stay with us. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We have vehicle maintenance expert Jim Ward back with us, service manager at Smart Motors Toyota of Madison. He's over 10 years of master certification. Great to have him with us. And he's here to answer your vehicle maintenance questions, of course. So, what problems are you having with your car? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Or send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. And I wanted to mention on our blog, if you go to the Larry Mueller Show blog, ideas@wpr.org/Larry, and on the right side you'll see our blog. We've got a little story quoting Jim on battery maintenance. If you want to take a look at that, the steps on getting a battery started were really quite valuable, I think. And that's on our blog. And we've got some other things as well. I hope you'll take a look. We've got an email from Lindsay, who is a rural mail carrier. I love those folks. She purchased 4 new wheels to be able to switch out snow tires and all-terrain tires easier. The car has a TPMS, so she's also got the sensors, valves specific to the car for each new wheel. Will the car configure the sensors itself when those wheels are put on, or does she need that done in another way?
Well, Lindsay gave us a lot of good information, but the key here is what kind of car is it? Toyotas do not learn the tire pressure sensors that are in them. We have to program them. Hondas do, and different manufacturers do this differently. Some of them, they will automatically learn. But the good news is that's something you can easily Google. Look up your vehicle, and it will tell you whether you have to go and have them programmed or whether the computer on the car will pick them up as you drive and learn. More and more manufacturers are going to the latter where they learn it themselves, and you don't have to go and have something special done to do it. So hopefully that's what yours are. But, yep, it's, you know, this in Wisconsin, we're used to having another set of wheels and snow tires. It just became quite a bit more complicated when tire pressure monitor systems came out.
Let's go to Dave in Conover. Hi, Dave.
Hey, Larry. Good to be on your show. Listen, I wanted to mention the woman called a few callers ago, and she had talked about her interior fogging up when she had, you know, a few extra people in the car.
Yep.
And I think, Jim, you may have missed the simplest solution to that, which, of course, is making sure that your restart button is not on or that you've got fresh air coming into the car. I have found in my experience, and I've worked on cars for some 30-plus years, that leaving it in recirc allows the cabin air to keep being drawn in and it's full of moisture. That, and also if the under the cowl is covered in a bunch of snow, pulling moisture through the fresh air vent. But as long as you have the fresh air on, it shouldn't be fogging up in there.
All right. Thanks, Dave. Comment, yep. Jim?
Oh, no, that's right. That's right. The I think we did talk about recirculating fresh air a little bit, and she had mentioned she'd taken it to a mechanic, so I'm, you know, typically that's going to be reviewed. But fresh air does have to get in as well on the intake, which is on that cowl under the wiper. Sometimes can get plugged up with leaves and different things.
Yep.
You know, the fact that she had taken it somewhere, I kind of think they'd probably covered those basics, but you're absolutely right. Yep, you got to be able to get that air in, and that typically is going to need to be on fresh air to keep the windows clear.
Thank you, Dave. Appreciate it. Nan in Mosinee, your turn. Hi, Nan.
Hi. I have a question on my Prius 2015. The check engine light came on, and I took it in, and they said our charcoal canister was bad. And I asked why that would happen, and he thought that we might have, when we top off our gas tank, when we fill it, that could do it.
Mm-hmm.
And the cost to replace that is a little over $800. Is that something we can replace ourselves? And if we chose not to replace it, what kind of, could that damage our car?
So that the charcoal canister is a device in the evaporative emission system. So this is a system that handles the fuel that vaporizes, and once upon a time, actually, we had vented gas caps that just released that in the atmosphere. It's now known to be a pollutant, so it's actually contained, and it's not a free-flow system, so those vapors are taken from over the gas in the tank. They're drawn into this canister and basically stored there, and then as you drive on demand, there are a set of hoses that go up to the engine intake, and they're part of the fuel that you burn when you drive. It doesn't really do much. It's very marginal to your fuel mileage, but it doesn't release those fumes into the air, into the atmosphere, which is the goal. So that system, you could operate your car indefinitely without that system working. It's not really going to change how the car operates, but the check engine light would stay on, and if you had a more serious concern, you may not realize it because you have that light on already. I don't know that that's the easiest do-it-yourself job. The way that that canister is removed from the car, I'm trying to imagine. I can't quite picture how you could do it with the car on the ground. It's typically done with the car up on a lift, because the canister is about 18 inches long, and the way you have to tip it and some things you have to take apart, you need more clearance than there is if the car is just sitting on the ground to get that in and out of there. I'm not saying you could do it yourself, but that, you know, involves jacking the car up and making sure that it's not just on a jack, that it's on jack stands and safe to do something like that. So, you know, I wouldn't say it's impossible to be a do-it-yourself job, but it's not the easiest one to do.
Yeah. But it should be done?
It should be done. Again, it's not a breakdown issue. The car would operate indefinitely without that system working. It's a pollution control system, but when the system's not working right, you know, you potentially are putting more into the atmosphere.
Yeah.
And it is true. The thing that's important to note about this, one of the things Nan mentioned, is that this is when you go to the gas pump and you fill up your car, when the pump shuts off, you should not put any more fuel in. You should not top it up. That canister is meant to handle fuel vapors, and if you top it up, you may get actual liquid fuel into the canister. The canister is full of little charcoal desiccant, little tiny pieces of charcoal that are kept in it by a type of fabric on each end of it, and the liquid gas can break that fabric down, the desiccant can get out, and that's what causes it to malfunction like this.
So there you go, Nan. Thank you so much for calling. Val in West Allis. Hi.
Hey, good afternoon, everybody.
What's on your mind?
I have a 2011 Kia Forte. It has 135,000 miles on it, and I took it in for an oil change. I just got it, and the guy told me, you know, your transmission fluid is like, it's black. I mean, you really need to change this. And so I called the transmission place, and he wanted to change it all. And while he was changing the oil, I called over to this transmission place that I go to on Layton, and she's like, oh, no, don't let him do it. You only want to change half the transmission fluid, because if you change it all, probably you're going to have some problems with your transmission because of the mileage issue. So that's my question is, do I change all the transmission fluid or just have them change half of it?
So there's different methods of doing this. You can, if you just take the drain plug out like you drain an engine, you only get part of the fluid because the rest of it stays in the torque converter. There are transmission flushing machines that are designed to flush that completely out and do it properly. That is the way I recommend doing it. There's been a longstanding myth that changing fluid on an older car, changing that transmission fluid, can cause damage to it. I've not seen that as a pattern. The damage I've seen from transmissions are from not changing the fluid and having the dirty fluid operate and cause things to start to stick and malfunction. But if you're going to do this service, I would recommend doing a method that changes it all.
All right. Thank you for calling, Val. Charlie in Sturgeon Bay, hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Appreciate your show.
Sure.
We own a couple of Priuses, and I've had to jumpstart them in the past, and I found it very frustrating because the positive stud, which is, of course, not on the battery itself, but it's available on the top deck there, is recessed into an area that makes it really difficult to get a jumper cable attached to it.
And you're doing this at the battery under this in the back of the car in the back quarter panel?
No, when you lift up the hood.
Okay, yeah, you're talking about the jump start.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, granted, it may not be the easiest thing to get to, but it is definitely far easier to get to than the battery itself. I mean, there's a cover that has to come off that panel, like most fuse panels under the hood. There's a little red tab you got to flip up, and it doesn't stick up like a battery post. It's true. It's a little flatter than that. So getting the jumper cable on there is a little trickier than just a battery that sits under the hood that's very available. But, they gave us that access because getting at the battery in the back is quite a bit more work than that even.
Yeah, so there you go. Len in Boulder Junction, you got a solution for keeping rodents out of cars.
Solution, what we have going on is we've had 26 Toyotas, and we park them outside throughout the years, and we have a mouse problem where they get inside the vehicles. Have you heard other people experiencing that?
Oh, sure. It's almost epidemic proportions on almost any make of car, yeah.
What we've noticed is a couple things is we've had more problems with the Toyotas than other brands of cars, and they're getting inside. And what we've noticed is they actually crawl up on the tires, and then they get into the engine compartments, and that's how they have their access. So what we've been doing is we put mouse traps on top of the tires, and then that way when they come up, we catch a lot of them.
Sure. Brilliant.
Mouse traps on top. That is great. I love that. Well, Jim Ward, thank you so much for being with us today. Jim is the service manager at Smart Motors, and it's always great to have him come by, and I'm sure that you'll be coming by when are you on? February 20th.
Yep. I think just after Valentine's Day, I'll be back with my love of cars.
All right. Jim will be back with his love of cars on the 20th of February. So we'll look forward to that as well. Well, the holiday season is here and New Year's Eve is right around the corner. And you know what? There are a few places throughout our state with some fun and unique twists on the big Times Square ball drop in New York City. Here's a few worth checking out.
People in New York City have been lowering a lighted ball at midnight since 1907. But folks in Wisconsin, well, we have a bit more imagination. Today on Time Out Wisconsin, we'll talk about three very different drops on New Year's Eve. First, we go to Prairie du Chien, where something fishy is going on. With us is Mike Ulrich, director of Prairie du Chien's Parks and Recreation Department. Thanks for being with us, Mike. What is dropping in Prairie du Chien on New Year's Eve?
Thanks for asking, Jill, I guess. We have a great event coming up that we've been doing for, 19 years, and we will be dropping the carp, actually. Lucky the carp.
He has a name?
Lucky. And that was when the founders, Kathy and Tom Nelson, put this together. They had a contest, and that was the name given, and I believe it was because over in China, the carp is a lucky fish. So
sure.
The name, and to give us luck for the new year.
Absolutely. That totally makes sense. Yeah. Now, it has changed a little bit over the years since they started it, though, hasn't it?
That's correct. Over the years, we did do the drop-in of the carp outdoors at downtown Prairie du Chien. We've kind of incorporated the last 10 years Carp Fest, which is a lead-up to the drop-in of the carp. So we have activities going on throughout the week at various locations in the community. And then now we still drop the carp, but we do it indoors. The weather's been, you know, awful nasty during some of those New Year's Eves. And so we still do the drop in the carp, but we do it indoors.
Indoors. Okay, mm-hmm. That makes sense. And is this a real carp?
It used to be real,
okay.
And because of the fact that now we're inside, it looks real, put it that way,
okay.
And it's a plastic carp, however. It's quite large, and we still drop it, and we still do the ceremony or kiss for good luck for it, too.
I saw that, too. So does everybody get a chance to kiss Lucky the carp?
Yes, everybody does have that chance.
It sounds like so much fun. And this is really a family-oriented event, isn't it?
Yeah, that's what we've tried to do. We just thought, I guess with me through the Parks and Rec Department, that was one of our goals, to try to keep things family-orientated. And here's some things you can do, you know, with the kids.
And it's relatively early, isn't it?
Yeah, we actually do the early bird drop, or early fish drop, if you want to call, starting at 5 o'clock. So we actually have a series of games and interactive events that the kids can do with their parents, and then we meet together have kind of a neat ceremony. I've got kind of some goofy guys coming in to sing, and then we give out the noisemakers, and we actually drop Lucky in our recreation center, and Happy New Year, and also they're able to kiss Lucky, and we do have some carp samples, too, so they can always see what Lucky really tastes like, too.
And some cool stuff like carp corn and hot carp chocolate.
Everything is there, including our carp king and queen, and so they can meet, you know, royalty.
Wow.
And we've got carp beads for them to wear, so we do the whole stick here, and it's all good fun, and it brings people to smiley faces, and we have a good time.
And that's the point, isn't it?
Exactly.
Well, Mike, thank you so much for taking some time and telling us about the carp drop.
Yes, I would welcome anybody to come and have some fun with us, and have a happy and healthy new year for you and everybody else.
Thank you, and to you too.
Yeah, thank you.
Should old acquaintance be forgotten, never brought to mind?
Next, let's go to Plymouth. Donna Hahn is the executive director of the Plymouth Arts Center. So, Donna, thanks for being with us. What's being dropped over in Plymouth for New Year's Eve?
Well, this is our 13th year of dropping the big cheese.
This is a real cheese.
It is not real cheese, but there's plenty of real cheese inside. But
great.
It's a replica of the Bellavitano Sartori cheese, and the Sartori Company is our sponsor, and they've created the big cheese for us.
And you like to bill yourself as the cheese capital of the world, is it?
Oh, well, we actually are the cheese capital of the world.
How did you get that title?
We have that designation for the last few years now. We've always been known as that. But we are officially the cheese capital of the world.
Wow, that's pretty darn cool, and a good place to do it right here in Wisconsin for sure.
Absolutely.
So what time does the cheese get dropped?
It's dropped at 10 o'clock, and we started that about 3 years ago because we wanted it to become more of a family-friendly event.
Uh-huh.
So we drop it at 10 so the kids can come out and enjoy. And then we still have our party going on inside the building with live music until midnight, and then we'll have a champagne toast at midnight. But at 10 o'clock, you know, we still have lots of children and lots of families, and the Sartori Company is actually donating 250 gift bags of cheese to the first 250 families that arrive for the event.
Now, that's a great bonus.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that you're looking at least a $12 to $15 value in that gift bag.
So is there a charge for the event?
It's absolutely free.
Okay.
All the way around.
Wonderful. And what else is going on inside the Arts Center?
Well, inside we're going to have the group called Bella Music start us off with some nice just variety music. And then we have the Honey Goats playing, and they're mainly a bluegrass band. And it's going to be lively. You can do a little dancing. We're going to have a cheese display there. Again, the Sartori Company is donating cheese, so you'll get a sample of cheese inside and then enjoy a bonfire outside. And, you know, we'll have hot chocolate out there. So it's just really a fun event.
Well, it certainly sounds like it, Donna. And I'm sure you have lots of people out there celebrating with you this year. Thanks so much for telling us about it.
Well, you're quite welcome, and thanks for asking. And please come to Plymouth,
okay,
the cheese capital of the world.
All right, thanks.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
For old anxiety, my dear, for old anxiety.
Finally, let's talk to Jamie Forrest, VP of Business Development with FM 106.9, The Lodge. What is being dropped in Sister Bay on New Year's Eve?
Well, it's Door County, so of course we have a giant cherry, and giant in the fact that it's about a 7-foot diameter sphere that's sort of like a hollow cage.
Okay.
That we adorn with big red lights, and we hoist it up onto about a 120-foot crane, hope that it's not going to be really windy, and wait for the countdown, just like our little version of Times Square.
Okay, so it is on at 12 o'clock on New Year's Eve, right?
It is. It is. You know, we've had a number of people that have asked, oh, can we just drop it early for the kids? And we're like, no, sorry, but this one's ours. It's adult night, and we're going to do it at midnight and Central Time.
Gotcha. So how did this event get started?
We had wanted to do a station event. We talked more and more about it as the station got to its 10th anniversary. And we thought, well, why don't we just have a really kind of fun party atmosphere and ring in the new year. You know, we went down to Husby's and the Sister Bay Bowl, who is our partners in this. They're like, hey, what if we make this big cherry? Can we put the crane on your property? And they're like, oh, sure. So it really was a group of about a half dozen people that we just wanted to have an opportunity for the community to come out and an activity for them to do. And the first year we raised about $500 for a local Secret Santa that helps people with home heating bills in the winter.
Oh, wonderful. Now, besides the Lodge cherry drop, what other things are going on that night there?
So Sister Bay does a nice event for the evening, too. They have fireworks near their sports complex, which is a big ice rink. Oh, I want to think it's about 8:30.
Okay.
That wraps up about 9, and then people just kind of have their own festivities.
Well, it sounds like a lot of fun, and I'm sure that people up in Door County are going to go out and experience that and have a wonderful time. Thanks for talking with us, Jamie.
Absolutely. Come out. Regardless of if it's cold, we just dress for the weather and make it happen.
Perfect. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thanks, Jill.
Lots of fun for New Year's Eve in Wisconsin. If you have an event you'd like to tell us about, email timeoutwisconsin@wpr.org and find links to the events that we talked about today at wpr.org/timeout. Here's wishing you a safe and happy New Year. I'm Jill Nadeau. Until next month, get out and explore, dream, and discover.
Well, you know, the cheese drops at 5, I think, and maybe you could drive quickly to Sister Bay and see the giant cherry drop. I don't know. But it all sounds like a whole lot of fun to me. You can find out more and see some photos from the events on our blog. You can find a link by going to wpr.org/Larry. And if you have a Time Out Wisconsin suggestion, I hope you will go to timeoutwisconsin@wpr.org. We'll have more for you next month. Until then, I hope you enjoy taking time out to get out and enjoy Wisconsin. I'm Larry Mueller.